491.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded and produced for WVUD and our podcast listeners by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. The opinions represented in this program by hosts or guests do not necessarily reflect those of WVUD, the University of Delaware, or my own political campaign committee. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at 12:30 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California to New York Island. Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 319, recorded on August 2nd, 2020. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from Idaho, as always, is Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
And on the line from D.C. is Kelly. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Rachel.
We're talking this week about the United States Postal Service. We're going to talk first about the current crisis that you may have heard about. This is something that's been talked a lot about on social media, but it's sometimes hard to piece together what's actually happening from that. So we figured we'd go into a little bit more detail about that. And then we're going to obviously do what we do best on this show for the past couple of years, which is take a deeper dive into the history of that thing. So we'll talk about the history of the Post Office Department and the United States Postal Service. So, Rachel, let's start with you. Can you give me kind of an overview of both the current sort of political crisis or whatever at the post office and also how we got here from the past, we'll say 17 years, and then, you know, before we get into the longer history before that?
Yeah. So, as some of you may have heard, there's a new Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy. And he was kind of brought in as a crony of Trump, kind of a business guy. He was in the logistics business before becoming the new Postmaster General. And it sounds like from what postal workers are saying and the postal workers union is saying, he's really trying to turn to run USPS as a business, not a service, not a valuable service that it is. So one of the first things he did is he has started to cut overtime. And as the coronavirus pandemic rages on, package and parcel shipments have increased dramatically. Right now, post offices are swamped. And at the same time, there's a lot of postal workers out sick due to the coronavirus, and there just isn't the staffing to replace them. So there's a delay in deliveries because DeJoy really wants to he wants to prioritize shipping like Amazon packages over other first class mail, things like letters and other first class packages. So this is really bad because a lot of veterans and disabled people receive their medications by mail. A lot of people are waiting for benefits checks. I saw a whole bunch of people waiting on unemployment checks, workers' compensation checks. Just any checks that's going through the mail is being delayed in certain neighborhoods. It definitely seems to be kind of a piecemeal patchwork. So some areas are getting affected way more than others. I saw on Twitter, Philadelphia is getting hit really badly because it is getting battered by the coronavirus pandemic. They're having a lot of staffing issues and mail is just piling up and there's nobody there to deliver it, especially without going into that overtime. At the same time, there's also been a steep drop in first class and marketing mail. Kind of that junk mail is the bread and butter of the U.S. Postal Service. It's very profitable to ship marketing mail, whereas the margins are a lot narrower for parcel and package shipping. So right now the post office is really hurting. The Treasury Department wants to make aid conditional on the Treasury Department overseeing U.S. Postal Service operations. That's obviously not what the USPS wants. So there's also that aspect of other state agent or other federal agencies trying to kind of take over operations and holding that aid hostage. Another thing that's been highly publicized is delaying first-class mail that arrives late to distribution centers if it's going to make carriers late on their routes. That's something that has never been emphasized in the U.S. Postal Service. And also, he's been trying to reduce carriers' park points. This is where carriers park their trucks and hand-deliver mail for several blocks before returning to their truck. It's kind of that iconic U.S. Postal Service like picture of mail carriers. And also, that's the point where mail carriers interact with their communities. People see their mail carriers carrying the mail by hand. It's kind of a picture of Americana. And also, this doesn't really make sense in neighborhoods where the mailboxes are like on the house or a mail slot rather than at the end of a driveway. It seems more efficient to just park the truck and walk the mail to those houses rather than drive like 10, 12 feet, park it, walk the mail up, walk back, so on and so forth. So that's something that's really scary now. And a lot of people are talking about November when a lot of people are going to be requesting mail-in ballots. So there's a deep concern that mail-in ballots are going to be deprioritized. And so people will be trying to mail them to their elections offices, and they just won't make it in time to be counted in elections. There's been a lot of, propaganda coming from Trump saying that there's high potential for elections fraud coming from these mail-in ballots that just doesn't bear out in reality. So I think he's just trying to sow a lot of confusion and a lot of panic around mailing in ballots and kind of delegitimizing the process of mailing in ballots. And this isn't the first that we've heard of the post office being under attack. Some of you may be aware of the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act of 2006. It was approved by a voice vote during the lame duck session of the 109th Congress and signed to law in December of 2006. And what it did is it required the USPS to pre-fund retirement and medical benefits up to 75 years in the future, which is something that is not being asked of any other public or private entity. So the effect of this is between 2007 and 2016, the USPS lost $62.4 billion. The Inspector General of the USPS estimates that $54.8 billion of that was due to pre-funding retiree benefits. By the end of 2019, the USPS had $160.9 billion in debt. This is due to the growth of the internet, the Great Recession, and also prepaying for employee benefits. Mail volume decreased from 97 billion to 68 billion items from 2006 to 2012. And the employee benefits cost the USPS about $5.5 billion per year. USPS began defaulting on this payment in 2012, and this has been further exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. So due to that decreased marketing mail and first-class mail happening. The Institute for Policy Studies published a paper in July 15th, 2019, How Congress Manufactured a Postal Crisis and How to Fix It, where they kind of talk about their suggestions for fixing this manufactured crisis. They stated, if the cost of this retiree healthcare mandate were removed from the USPS financial statements, the post office would have reported operating profits in each of the last 6 years. So the last 6 years prior to 2018. This extraordinary mandate created a financial quote-unquote crisis that has been used to justify harmful service cuts and even calls for postal privatization. Additional cuts in service and privatization would be devastating for millions of postal workers and customers. So they recommend four things. They recommend repealing this pre-funding mandate and to allow USPS to use accumulated post-retirement reserves to fund future pay-as-you-go costs. Adopt generally accepted accounting principles for determining USPS liabilities. They are now required to calculate this retiree benefit based on the assumption that all current postal workers will be working there until retirement age, which just doesn't happen. Their third suggestion is Medicare integration for future postal retirees. So as of right now, retirees prior to 2019, postal retirees had the choice between using the federal health benefits program or Medicare once they reached age 65. And then in 2019, there was actually a bill that passed the House and the Senate that integrate Medicare into postal retiree benefits. So I'm not sure what the effect of that is yet. That probably remains to be seen. And four, they suggest eliminating the requirement to invest solely in treasury bonds, which I was unaware that that this requirement existed. You don't really see that in any other retiree or pension scheme. There's a lot more leeway into what entities are allowed to invest in. I think that requirement would really help because then they would be able to pick and choose the bonds and funds that they can put money into and probably have a better return rate than treasury bonds. Right now there's bills in the House and the Senate called the USPS Fairness Act. The House bill did pass. However, the Senate bill is stuck in the Committee of Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs. So it's probably not going to go anywhere this session. But if you have senators in this committee, I would encourage you to start bugging their offices or also encouraging your senators to co-sponsor the USPS Fairness Act. So that's kind of a big picture overview of why the USPS is hurting right now.
All right. So, Kelly, you did some research about sort of public opinion on the USPS and some of the obvious benefits that the Postal Service brings. And, you know, we'll talk more about the historical benefits, but there's still a lot of present day benefits, contrary to what some people thought was going to happen with, you know, the age of email and all of that, where, oh, it'll all just move online and there won't be any need for mail anymore.
So I think one of my concerns as we listen to Rachel's telling of the current moment is that we're entering a cycle where a public service, in this case the post office, is underfunded, and then it becomes underperforming, and then people don't like it, so they continue to underfund it. The post office up until now has been fairly successful in avoiding that sort of cycle. And as of April this year, about 91% of Americans had a favorable opinion of the Postal Service. That's according to a Pew Research poll. That the next sort of highest scoring, most favorable opinion government institution is the CDC, which at the time had a 79% favorable rating. So you can see sort of just how well-liked the U.S. Postal Service is and how trusted it is. And it's worth noting that most Americans sort of interact with the Post Service way more frequently than most other government institutions and sort of continue to have a high favorability rating for a lot of the reasons that Rachel mentioned earlier. One fact that I was really surprised to learn was that 48% of the mail is actually in the whole world is actually handled by USPS, which I think just goes to show the sort of the scope of the work that they do and the importance of it, not only to the US economy, but to the world economy. A lot of people, individuals and businesses, rely heavily on the Postal Service. A couple years ago, Urban Institute tried to think about a framework for considering the value of the Postal Service, and specifically a social framework. As we think about the Postal Service, I think it's worth noting that, in my opinion, the goal shouldn't be to make it profitable. The Postal Service does a lot of things which are, like, unprofitable. And the reason they do that is in service to democracy, essentially, as we'll get into a little bit later with the history. But the country really needs a well-functioning communication network. And while many communities and most people in the U.S. now are plugged into the internet, not everyone is and not everyone wants to be. And it remains an important way for the country, for the government to be able to reach its citizens. I mean, you think about the vote by mail that Rachel mentioned, you think about the census, all of that relies really heavily on the Postal Service and has a value far beyond economics and profitability. And so Urban Institute went about trying to sort of list all of the ways in which the Postal Service has social value. And a lot of them you can sort of guess at. There's a lot of commercial benefits as far as giving people access to goods, you know, across the country and across the world. There's commercial benefits in terms of the advertisements that businesses can send via mail. There are commercial benefits just as far as setting baseline pricing. And the USPS also does a lot of that sort of last mile delivery service for UPS and FedEx. So UPS can make a profit bringing it to a certain point, but after that, it's no longer profitable for them. And in some of those more rural settings, they hand it over to USPS to sort of take it the last leg of the trip. But there are also a number of things that I was surprised to learn about USPS. One is its role in responding to disasters. And Urban Institute writes, USPS is a leader in responding to disasters. It addresses its address base, enables government and other responders to find people. E.g. FEMA and the American Red Cross used the database after Katrina. USPS is a logistics company, more action-oriented than other federal agencies, and is accustomed to delivering every day. In fact, USPS is also often the first sort of interaction that people have with the government after a disaster. USPS also has an important role in reaching out to the blind and the disabled. The blind and the disabled can get reading materials delivered for free. They also deliver medical supplies and medication to people who cannot safely leave their home. I think in our current moment, we see that now more than ever. People who are immunocompromised or live with people who are immunocompromised or have any other sort of number of conditions or concerns about the current moment, use the mail to get all sorts of necessary things delivered, whether it be food or toilet paper or medication. And so this has become an increasingly important network in our current moment. The last thing that I wanted to mention is just what a big employer USPS is. How many jobs that USPS has in those sort of like, you know, the friendly neighborhood folks that are delivering your mail. They're in every neighborhood across the country, and USPS continues to be a huge employer, especially of minorities. So and it historically has been for quite a while. So as we think about the value of the post office, I think it means a lot to a lot of people and a lot of marginalized populations. And it's important that we recognize it as an institution of democracy and not just a business like we might want to think about it. It's not really comparable to FedEx or UPS because it serves a number of other roles for our country.
So as Kelly just said, the postal system in the United States has many different functions beyond just the ones that you would obviously think. And fundamentally, based on the functions that Kelly just described, we as a people deserve a government postal service that works for all of us, that is not for profit, that is acting on behalf of the government, on behalf of all of us as citizens, as residents, whether we're citizens or not. This is something that we deserve as a society. The great news is that a lot of the functions of the Postal Service are very profitable and always have been profitable. And in many, you know, there's been ups and downs over the years, but in many ways, you know, if you take away some of the unnecessarily applied political burden, some of which Rachel talked about, there are things that the Postal Service could be doing that actually would be keeping it net profitable year over year, if that was something that, you know, you felt like we needed to have the thing entirely self-funding. But as Kelly just said, there's also a case to be made that that doesn't necessarily need to be the focus, because there's so many services that are provided to the, you know, American people, and making sure that there's, you know, some non-private entity that's delivering their censuses, delivering their ballots, things like that, that we deserve to have a public system remain in place. So we're going to talk now about the history of the postal system in the United States. From 1970 onward, it's the United States Postal Service, USPS, as we know. Before then, it was the Post Office Department, the United States Post Office Department, which was a cabinet-level position. Now, of course, before the, you know, U.S. Constitution was created, under the constitutional Congress system, folks like Ben Franklin and some others were pushing really hard to develop a intercolonial postal system, so that you could, you know, send a letter between like Massachusetts and Philadelphia or something like that. Previously the royal system of mail delivery was not only very expensive, but also was fundamentally geared toward sending mail from the colonies back to the home country in Britain. It was not really geared toward sending mails within colonies and between the colonies of what became the 13 colonies of the United States. So it was a very early priority for them to set that up, as I think most people are familiar. But when the Constitution rolls around, Article 1, Section 8 includes that the Congress shall have power to establish post offices and post roads. And this ends up becoming pretty critically important for the development of the United States as a whole, which I guess is going to get a little bit controversial here in terms of some of the stuff about the post office that's not so great. This initial framing in the Constitution was fairly quickly reinterpreted in 1838 to include railroads. So post roads also meant railroads. And this allowed the federal government to justify providing financial support and incentives for building railroads, including eventually in the 1860s, the transcontinental lines. The Pacific Railroad Act of July 1862 was an act to aid in the construction of a railroad and telegraph line from the Missouri River to the Pacific Ocean, and to secure to the government the use of the same for postal, military, and other purposes. This was intended largely to replace the seaborne mail service that went to either side of what's now the country of Panama, at the time just the Isthmus of Panama, within Colombia. You know, there were some limited stagecoach service, and very briefly there was the Pony Express for maybe a couple of years or so, but those were really not the way you would send mail to someplace like California. And remember, there was a period such as the 1860s when this act was passed where almost no one from the United States, we're not talking about indigenous people here for the moment, almost no one from the United States lived in the sort of middle area of the country between the Missouri River and the Pacific coast. People had jumped across that and started settling in places like California, Oregon, Nevada, and that sort of thing. And so for the most part, if you were sending a letter, it just made more sense timing-wise and was actually faster to put it on a boat across the Caribbean to Panama, and then from Panama up the coast of Mexico to California. So the Transcontinental Railroad was intended to replace that. But as it says, with the building these railroads for the postal, military, and other purposes, you can see that the Postal Service also had some sort of darker functions within the context of the early United States. So there was some interesting stuff on one of the Wikipedia articles, actually, about the United States Post Office Department, some analysis that various scholars have provided that I thought was interesting, which was on the role of the post office in American nationalism and political consolidation. So in terms of its nationalist functions, mail service connected non-elites, just ordinary people, over long distances for the first time, or at least allowed them to stay in touch, right? So if someone moved away from you in, you know, Massachusetts to Ohio or to Illinois or to, you know, Wisconsin or the Dakotas, you could stay in touch. They didn't just disappear from your life because we had this mail service. This was essential for a settler colonial project that was expanding rapidly west. It was also essential for developing a shared identity instead of purely regional or local identities. Obviously, we talk a lot in the early American history about like the sectional crises and sectionalism in the United States. So there definitely was very strong regional identities, but it is possible that if you hadn't had something like the mail service, you could very easily have never really developed a coherent identity as the United States. Maybe the, you know, United Colonies would have remained extremely loose. They would have had like their Articles of Confederation, Continental Congress stuff, just sort of persist for some of their common defense or common foreign policy or something like that. But there would never have been maybe some sort of national interior policy and things like that. Mail service was instrumental in facilitating the propaganda of the frontier life and appeals and advertising for people to move there or invest there, as well as keeping those people who moved there supplied with merchant goods at a relatively low cost, which is obviously something that the Postal Service still does today, but it was particularly important at the time. Mail service also facilitated military control between the frontier and the periphery, as well as along the frontier over large geographical areas, particularly before the advent of telegraphs. So you can see that the mail service in the United States originally went pretty hand in glove with the sort of military project against the indigenous peoples. These days, of course, that's not the goal of the Postal Service, and you get some really interesting tidbits about the Postal Service, like how there's still a mule-delivered mail service in a very remote and inaccessible place to a Native American reservation. And so that's a sort of a different outlook, but originally we should acknowledge that in the first half of the 19th century and part of the second half of the 19th century, a major aspect of the Postal Service had to do with facilitating the military and settler projects against the indigenous people. In terms of political consolidation, this one is something that's also really interesting to my mind. Party identity could be formed within and across the American sections with the rise of so-called national newspapers that could be delivered over long distances by mail services, and parties, political parties, could support themselves by controlling the patronage jobs of the federal postal employees. Now, of course, in 1883, after the assassination of the president by a disgruntled person that had wanted a patronage job, the Pendleton Act was adopted that eliminated most of the federal patronage system. We're talking thousands of jobs. We're talking the vast majority of all federal jobs at that point, because the federal government was still pretty small, even in the late 19th century. The vast majority of those jobs were postal jobs. But before then, before the Pendleton Act finally replaced those, partly because the unqualified people with no postal experience were pretty unhelpful to running the postal system. At that point, the mail clerks, like the lowest level employees, had to be pretty qualified and have met all kinds of benchmarks, like memorizing all of the post offices in the United States and stuff like that, because there weren't zip codes and things. This was a period before the Pendleton Act where the political parties could get, you know, a paper from New York delivered anywhere in the country to know what was going on with the broader party. In addition to all the little local newspapers, you could have the local newspapers delivered locally by the Postal Service. You could have these politicians that would otherwise just potentially be like little, you know, having little fiefdoms in their little area, kind of like what we'd see in Europe. Instead, they could form this sort of national super identity where you could have a national Democratic Party, a national Republican Party, that sort of thing. So the Postal Service was pretty instrumental, again, in consolidating across those sectional lines. One of the interesting sort of innovations, as we talked about with the railroads being critically important to the Postal Service, is railway post offices. These were rolling post offices that could both pick up in each town en route and sort mail while traveling, so that it did not have to be, as it had previously been done, routed to central processing facilities. Like, you could have had a system where all of the mail in the country that wasn't local mail or whatever had to go to, like, Washington, D.C. or something like that, and then get sent back out. You know, there are any number of ways that it could have been handled in a very complicated manner, but instead they came up with this other way of doing it. Now, of course, mail, in terms of not processing it but just moving it like freight, mail had been carried by train in Britain since the 1830s, and for some time informally or semi-formally in the U.S. not long after that. Dedicated mail cars, however, were introduced in the United States in 1862. Rolling mail sorting cars were devised in the U.S. in 1864, apparently by a postal worker, who realized that it could be handled more efficiently along the intermediate route rather than just shipping long-distance mail like it was freight. So, of course, you know, if you know that you have a letter that's not for a town that's on, you know, a stop on your train route, but maybe it's a little bit off of that on another branch line, you could have a postal worker pick up the mail in one town, take it to another town, and have it go get dropped off in that town to be put on a different train to go, you know, off of the main line and deliver it to that other town. And that avoids the need of having a central processing facility or unloading it at some specific, you know, warehouse and sorting it there and then putting it back on trains and so forth. Again, it required a pretty significant level of talent to be able to do this, though. You had the guys crammed into these postal cars, frantically sorting mail as fast as possible between stations that they had picked up, and they had to know where pretty much every single post office in the country was. There would be all kinds of tests where if you got like below a 96% proficiency or whatever, they could fire you because you needed to have this just immense level of skill to be able to do this. So mail handling became a prestige, although often money-losing business for American railroads. We talked about this a bit before, I think, on a previous episode when we were talking about railroad rate shipping wars for freight and that sort of thing. In the Road of the Century book from 1947 by Alvin F. Harlow, which we talked about on that episode, railroads like the New York Central and the Pennsylvania Railroad began running postal cars or even entire postal trains on behalf of the U.S. Postal Service at a revenue loss, especially being on the hook for maintenance costs for those cars. And this was very unprofitable compared to private express delivery services who also shipped with them, but it was very profitable for the U.S. Postal Service and helped keep the costs down for consumers. For a couple of decades, you could spot a mail car easily because it would be this gleaming white car, but eventually they painted them to match the specific railroad's colors. Then another sort of interesting innovation in 1867 came with high-speed mail sack grabbers, so the local mail could be picked up without even stopping an express train as it passed through the station at about 70 miles per hour or more. They would bundle up all the mail that was going to that station they were going through without stopping, and they would hurl it out of the train as hard as they possibly could as they went whipping through the station, and they would have this arm that would swing out from the car and grab this sack of mail off of like an arm that was hanging on the station very loosely, and it would swing the mail into the car and drop off that sack, and then they would proceed to sort that mail and so forth. Mail cars also had a slot on the side so that if they did stop at a station, people could walk up to them like you would do with a mailbox today and just put the mail in. And that made it very convenient. People would really liked doing that to get the mail there faster because, you know, if you actually went to the post office, then the post office has to take it to the train and maybe they don't do that until the next day. So you could potentially save some time by just going to the station when you knew the train was going to be coming by and stopping there. And maybe it would only stop there for a couple of minutes, but you could put your mail in and it would get there faster. Between 1942 and 1977, the USPS did gradually phase out rail mail cars, particularly after regional machine sorting centers were established. So they finally did eventually go back to the model of having specific offloading locations and warehouses and so forth where they would sort things. And we're not going to get into it a huge amount today. We might actually come back to this topic because there's a lot of interesting Postal Service history that we could get into that we didn't have time for in this episode. There basically was a big problem, especially after sort of computerization began in major corporations, where suddenly they were sending out all these, you know, automated things like here's your billing information and that sort of thing. The mail like started to go way up in terms of volumes. You also had like a lot more catalogs and junk mail and type of things. And so in that period, from World War II until, you know, the 1960s or so, you started actually having such high volumes of mail that it was very difficult for the mail workers to process stuff without the assistance of machines. And so things like the mail cars just became impractical because the volume of mail that was being sent was not capable of like fitting into these cars and having individual people sort them. And so it was just easier to offload them to these sort of warehouse locations and have some machine assistance on some of that gradually, especially after the 1960s. In 1967, the USPS ended other contracts for rail transport of mail, opting for air freight mail or trucking instead. Sometimes occasionally after the 1970s, you would get bulk or commercial or catalog type mail being shipped as freight by rail between processing centers because it was so heavy. It was too heavy for the trucks and the planes to transport efficiently, but you could just throw it on a train and have like a whole car full of, you know, catalogs and things like that. But that wasn't like a mail car sorting them or anything. The USPS had previously had some postal boats, like steamboats or lake boats, things like that, that were under the aegis of their rail program for delivery to like rural lake or riverfront communities. That ended in 1978 as well. Air mail had been a huge thing. We talked about that on a previous episode. The U.S. government made a huge investment all over the country in airfield and air navigation infrastructure across the country to make the postal delivery system by air possible. That was sort of an interesting system when they took it over in 1918 from the Army, and they got various, you know, veteran pilots from World War One to come fly these things. They would, similarly to like hurling the mail out of a train car as it went through at 70 miles an hour, they would fly over a little town and drop a sack of mail sometimes. That was, you know, often not, I mean, it's not necessarily the most efficient way of doing it, but in some cases it was maybe more accessible to do it that way. But when we talk about air mail today, we're really talking more just about like putting a pallet of mail on a, you know, cargo plane or something. There also, obviously, another historical feature that a lot of people have heard of, which we're not going to go into a whole lot today, the Comstock laws of 1873, and some of the previous laws of the late 1860s. Those were like anti-obscenity laws where you start to regulate and restrict what can be sent through the Postal Service, including, unfortunately, there had been a period at the beginning of the Second Industrial Revolution, or even before then, when you could advertise mail order, like, abortion pills, basically. You know, those are something that was relatively popular in the cities especially, but I'm sure also in rural areas. And the real, you know, these guys that didn't want that and thought that was morally improper or whatever, started to ban all of those things. And even information on sexual health and sex education materials for a long time could not be sent through the mail. And this was an impediment not just to single people, but also to married couples, and was a huge problem for many decades. So that's something that you can look up more on if you want to learn more about that. Some of this stuff that we got was actually from the official 2020 history of the United States Postal Service and the Post Office Department. I don't know if this is something they release every year or if it was just something they happened to release this year, but this was pretty interesting. Kelly and I read through a lot of it. It's I think about 147 pages long or so, but it just has all these amazing anecdotes in it. And as usual, we'll have this and other links that we've talked about today up at arsenalfordemocracy.com, as always, when the episode goes up. But just a few more historical things to try to highlight some of the sort of benefits and innovations brought by the postal system in the United States. So doorstep delivery in cities with high, i.e. profitable, volumes of local mail began in 1863 after it had been demonstrated in Britain that free doorstep delivery actually encouraged higher usage of the postal system and thus generated more revenues than it cost to provide delivery beyond the post office. Previously, people had to go to the post office to pick up their mail. Also at the time in 1863, Union soldiers, not having postage on the front lines, were sending mail to be paid upon delivery by the recipient. This was a temporary measure that had been allowed, and you needed people to go to the post office to pick it up in order to pay for it, or you could have the mail person go to their house and get the postage there. Mailboxes at home, however, did not arise until 1912, so mail carriers had to circle back repeatedly until someone was actually home before they could deliver if nobody was home. I'm sure that, you know, if you were in a community where you had a stay-at-home parent, usually the mother, who was always at home, that was probably less of a concern. But if you were in an area that, you know, like like urban tenements where everyone went to work at the factory during the day or something, maybe there wouldn't be somebody at home. So that could be a little inconvenient and inefficient. And they did all kinds of calculations and figured out how much time and money they were wasting on this. And they were like, why don't we just have secure mailboxes that the postal worker can drop stuff off at? Doorstep delivery after 1863 also included multiple deliveries per day, which I don't think happens at all today anymore, both to business districts and residential districts, but especially to business districts, because mail was time sensitive for businesses. And we talked about in a previous episode how the Second Industrial Revolution featured the paperwork revolution, which had begun with the rise of cheap wood fiber manufactured paper and cheaper means of writing. And so all of a sudden you had way more commercial and business and business to business mail that was happening. You know, you had to get urgent messages out and so forth. And I think other countries solved this by just having, like, if you read the Sherlock Holmes books, for the original Sherlock Holmes books, there's a lot of mentions of like, and then he sent a messenger boy running across the city to deliver this message. But in the United States, the way this was typically handled, which, you know, probably unleashed a huge amount of commercial potential, was to have the post office have multiple deliveries during the day so you could send mail across the business district to some other company to work something out. And remember, there is a period between the advent, before the advent of the telephone, and also people didn't necessarily want to send telegraphs, because that's not a convenient way either. You still have to have someone usually bring it to you to read it to you if you're not actually at the telegraph's outpost. So there was a period of a couple decades, or at least a decade or so, in the Second Industrial Revolution where it was really important to have this mail service. The multiple deliveries per day continued until the 1920s, when the process of scaling back on and off over several decades reduced the number of deliveries to businesses and residents. Multiple deliveries were gone completely by the 1990s. However, interestingly, and I think this is an interesting point of comparison, especially to today and what's going on now with the Postal Service, there was often public backlash to any attempt to cut service or deliveries, whether it was Saturday deliveries, whether it was the number of deliveries per day. Usually the backlash was so severe that often within a matter of days, you would have the president or Congress or both acting to try to remedy the situation and provide more resources or whatever the Postal Department needed to try to correct this. And that is not something that we're seeing today. We're not seeing the president or Congress jumping in to try to save the postal system. Rural free delivery was another important change, RFD. This had some positive effects and some negative effects. This extended free doorstep delivery to rural areas in 1899, after nearly a decade of debate and controversy over the idea. The doorstep delivery in the urban areas had been very profitable because there was a ton of local mail and a high enough volume of mail to justify it. Rural mail, again, we run into that persistent problem of not necessarily having the volumes to justify it. And so they had this very big debate on it because they knew it wasn't going to pay for itself, unlike the doorstep delivery in the urban areas. The rural service led to the creation of the Postmaster General approved mailboxes before they were introduced in cities. Basically, you didn't want your stuff to get rained on or snowed on or whatever out in the country, and you didn't want to get the animals getting into it, etc. So you had to have these sort of lock boxes, and that eventually led them to introducing mailboxes in the urban areas as well. The rural service was also the initial model deployed in early suburbs. In 1910, a narrow majority of the U.S. population lived in rural areas, but I think that may have also included those early suburbs. And if I had to guess, I would say, again, some of the sort of suburban life is made possible only by the existence of the United States Postal Service and this rural free delivery program. They would have had to organize their suburban communities differently and probably much more densely early on if it had been not covered in that way, is my guess. I don't know. That's just my sort of take on it. In 1890, just so that you're aware of sort of the statistics we're talking about, so you can see why a lot of this stuff was paying for itself, at least in the urban areas, the post office delivered over 4 billion pieces of mail back in 1890. So people sometimes wonder, like, well, you know, the postal rates are so low, how does it pay for itself? How is it profitable? And it's because of the absolutely huge amounts of volumes of mail. And even after the sort of decline with the internet age, we're still seeing a pretty significant amount of mail being sent, even setting aside packages. In 2000, the Postal Service delivered 207.9 billion pieces of mail, and that was down to 142.6 billion in 2019. And then, Kelly, you wanted to mention briefly, before we go back to Rachel, about one other innovation from the postal system.
Yeah, so in part of the history of the postal system is really the history of creating such a ginormous logistics system. And one of the things that was created that we now, or I now anyway, take for granted, are zip codes, which were only introduced in 1963. But as Bill mentioned, due to the huge volume of mail, and especially with the advent of cheaper paper and sort of the printing out of bank statements and all the other sorts of good things we get, it became impractical for this system to rely on people knowing every single post office there was in the United States. And so the zip codes was created as a tool to help improve the efficiency of the system, and then later led to other possible innovations like the sort of the automation of the process. But really, it's it goes back to sort of thinking about USPS as a giant logistics company for the nation, and really building this database of addresses and this system of zip codes, which now other mailing companies rely on as well.
Yeah. So one of the other things that happened, as you know, the zip code system was created and you started gradually getting to a process where you could potentially mechanize it, although the postal system was pretty slow on the uptake on that. The big challenge that a lot of the postal workers were finding themselves in was that even despite some of these innovations that were happening, they were getting totally overwhelmed. It was not just a matter of, oh, hire more people. It was that the volumes were becoming astronomical in the 1960s. The facilities, the physical facilities, were no longer big enough to support much of the stuff that was happening and so forth. And they were just becoming totally overwhelmed, right? You didn't have enough places for the workers. You didn't have enough places for the mail. It was hard to get things processed quickly. And it was just, it was becoming a huge mess. So there was growing discontent over the course of the 1960s, and there was clear to federal leaders and the federal government that some sort of change needed to be made. Now, this is the era that under the Nixon years in the late 1960s, early 1970s, when you could have potentially gone in the direction, and this was floated at one point, of doing it like Amtrak, where you spin it off. It's no longer a government agency. I mean, in the case of Amtrak, they were taking it over from private companies. But the Postal Service, they thought, well, maybe we'll spin it off. It won't be a government agency anymore. It'll just be this sort of public corporation that's then kicked around like Amtrak is and doesn't necessarily get the resources it needs, that sort of thing. And fortunately, that's not what ended up happening. But a lot of that had to do with pretty direct pressure from the workers themselves. So, Rachel, could you talk to us a little bit about the postal strike of March 1970 and the reorganization of the post office department into the United States Postal Service?
Yeah, so the U.S. postal strike in 1970 was an 8-day strike by federal postal workers in March of 1970. So the strike began in New York City, where working conditions were really unhealthy and unsafe. The American Postal Workers Union president at the time, Mo Biller, described Manhattan post offices as like, quote, dungeons. They were dirty, stifling, too hot in summer and too cold in winter. So also management was just haphazard, and unions were really weak at the time. Postal union lobbying of Congress to obtain higher pay, better benefits, and better working conditions just weren't working. So at that time, there was a congressional decision to raise the wages of postal workers by only 4%. And at the same time, Congress raised its own pay by 41%. So that really angered a lot of postal workers. And they actually struck illegally. They weren't allowed to strike, and it became the largest wildcat strike in U.S. history. It was mostly localized to New York City, but it did spread to some other cities in the following 2 weeks. So one thing to note is that at that time, the post office had a lot of Black workers, and this proportion increased as white people left postal work in the 1950s and 60s for better jobs. So it was just a bunch of marginalized people just really getting put upon by the federal government and just getting more and more upset about the low wages and poor conditions. And at this time, they could look to the civil rights movement as kind of a guidelines on how effective demonstrating was and civil disobedience. They did strike for 8 days. However, President Nixon brought in the National Guard to deliver mail. They obviously wouldn't be as successful at it just because of the logistical issue. They were untrained. They were unqualified. However, after the strike ended, it did lead to the Postal Reorganization Act, which did give collective bargaining rights to the postal unions. There were four major postal unions at the time, the National Association of Letter Carriers, the American Postal Workers Union, the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, and the National Rural Letter Carriers Association. So they won the right to negotiate on wages, benefits, and working conditions. However, they still were not allowed the right to strike. Also at this time, the United States Post Office Department was abolished. It was then part of the cabinet, as Bill mentioned earlier. And this act created the United States Postal Service, which is a corporation-like independent agency, and it has an official monopoly on the delivery of mail in the United States. So this really ties in to what we've been talking about in the past few weeks about monopolies. So they actually are an actual public monopoly on the delivery of mail. This act was signed into law by President Nixon on August 12, 1970. So the strike, while it was short in duration, it did actually affect a lot of change at the time.
Now, one of the other topics that we've talked about previously on Arsenal for Democracy is about postal banking. And we had done episodes about that in August 2014 and in November of 2017. And so we don't need to go into a huge amount of detail, but we should at least briefly talk about that before we wrap up today. Rachel, could you sort of recap the history of postal banking? Because it's not just a proposal to bring it back now. It's something that was a pretty significant force in American life for a period of U.S. history.
Yeah, so from 1911 to 1967, we did actually have a postal savings account system, our postal banking. It was enacted by President Taft, and it was started to help immigrants who were used to postal savings accounts in their home countries. At the time, banks weren't backed by the government, so it was also for people who didn't have faith in the banks. And also, it just provided a really convenient place for working people to deposit their money. So at the time, the minimum deposit was $1, and the maximum balance of the savings account was $500, excluding interest. At first, deposits were slow, but by 1929, $150 million were deposited in these savings accounts. Savings spurted to $1.2 billion during the 1930s, and then again during World War II, at their peak in 1947, there was almost $3.4 billion in these savings accounts. On April 27th, 1966, the Post Office Department stopped accepting deposits to existing accounts, refused to open new accounts, and cut off interest payments as the annual anniversary date of existing accounts came up. The system ended officially on July 1st, 1967, and there were about $50 million in unclaimed deposits that got turned over to the U.S. Treasury Department to be held in trust indefinitely. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
All right, Rachel, your final thoughts?
I think, as we've talked about monopolies in these past few weeks, I think it's really good to see what a successful publicly run monopoly looks like and how just popular it is and how cost effective it is. So I think it would be really dangerous to try to privatize it, which is what people on the right are attempting to do right now. So I think people just really need to express their support for the USPS.
Kelly, your final thoughts?
Yeah, similar to Rachel, I'm just thinking about how there's always room for improvement, right? But generally, the post office has remained pretty flexible in personalizing the services to whatever community they're serving. People like them. They do what they're supposed to do. And it would be a real shame if we undermined that public trust in the service it provides to all sorts of communities across the country by underfunding them and continuing to expect them to be funding their retirement system 75 years out.
Kelly, thank you so much for being on the show this week.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
And Rachel, thank you for being on the show as well.
Thanks, Bill.